This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. The anti-communist Red Scare of the mid-20th century has been a stain on U.S. history, and one with roots in Wisconsin. Senator Joseph McCarthy is often thought of as the face of that era as a result of his claims that he had a list of communists that had infiltrated the U.S. government.
But McCarthy was just one part of the Red Scare. The House Un-American Activities Committee was one of the main tools used in the anti-communist campaign. It investigated Americans thought to have ties to communism, most infamously Hollywood celebrities. The investigations led to the Hollywood blacklists.
An exhibit at Jewish Museum Milwaukee explores the impact of the blacklists on Hollywood films and the people who made them. Ellie Gettinger is the education director at the museum, and she joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers at the exhibit. She starts by dispelling a prominent myth.
There is no singular blacklist. Each radio station, each television station, each movie studio has a whole department that is dedicated to making sure who's working, who's not. And so there's no, like, this is the universal blacklist, although there was probably a universal blacklist, but there was also a Paramount one and a RKO one and a Columbia. You know, all of these different organizations have their own facilities moving.
So there's no way to know if you have been cited by one of these organizations because there isn't.
Right. And then if you are cited, if you're someone who, you know, it comes up that you signed this petition and you did this and this, and I mean, the only real ways off the blacklist are you testify in front of HUAC and you name other people. That becomes the kind of question of loyalty there is naming other people. A representative from California actually said the ultimate test of the credibility of a witness is the extent to which he is willing to cooperate with the committee in giving full details as to not only the pace of activities, but also the names of those who participated in the Communist Party. And the names become way more important than the pace of activities. And for the most part, all of the people who are named are names they already have. You know, it's not like this is new information, but this is that public showing of, hey, well, I was a communist and I'm remorseful for that, and I now am willing to name these other people. And you get some people who do it because they believe strongly that this is the right thing to do, and you get some people to do it because they feel like this is the only way that they can keep working. We have four kind of models of naming names. We have Larry Parks, who is one of these people who was, like, pulled out of him. It was the worst day. You know, he's an Academy Award nominated actor. He's on his way up. He's, you know, this is, and he spends all day saying, let me tell you about the Communist Party. I'm happy to tell you about what they did. Finally, in an executive session, they're like, you got to give us names or this isn't going to count. And so he does. But then because he had been so unwilling for the right, that is seen as not being a good witness, and he is no longer allowed to work. And on the left, he's considered to be a pariah as well. So he ends his career in dinner theater. It's kind of one of these great tragic stories that you can't win for losing. And on the flip side, Elia Kazan really felt that the party had tried to limit his creative freedom. And so he testified. I don't think he was happy to testify, but in testifying, he felt like he was doing the right thing. And that this was a fulfillment of a patriotic duty. And his movie, On the Waterfront, really becomes an exploration of this is what, for him at least, this is why I testified. This is me speaking truth to power. This is me overcoming what I saw as terrible injustice. Other people saw differently.
Yeah. What about the blacklist, and specifically the Hollywood blacklist, connect so deeply to the Jewish experience in America?
There were a huge number, and it was a larger proportion than the number of Jews in society, of Jews who were blacklisted. And I like to think of it in terms of a Venn diagram. If you look at that Venn diagram of people in Hollywood, people in leftist causes in Hollywood, both of those have high penetrations of Jews. And so if you put them together, that middle line is going to have a larger percentage of Jewish people. So there were a number of Jewish people who were impacted on one hand. And then the other side of this is the film studios are the ones who enlist, who enact the blacklist. And they are from a higher percentage also Jewish. And there was this real sense of, I think, post-World War II fear of position, fear of, you know, we need to make sure we maintain our market share. And so all of these things push them into this. You know, it's interesting in looking at our movies that were considered subversive, the ones that take on anti-Semitism are produced by studios that have non-Jewish execs at the top. Because Jewish filmmaker, studio execs didn't want to make that case. They wanted to be, hey, we're Jewish in America. This is a great place to be. And we're happy here. You know, they didn't want to rock the boat at all in that way. The other Jewish story that emerges is several of the members of the House Un-American Activities Committee were actually actively anti-Semitic. There were three who were members of the KKK. There was one guy, a representative from Mississippi, who was known as kind of this leading anti-Semite. He called Walter Winchell the K-word on the floor of Congress. Like, and he went and he does this whole dog whistle piece. And I think there is this moment in this time period and before where communism is a dog whistle for Judaism. And there are a number of people who equate those two things together. So you get him reading off the names of people on the floor of Congress. And actually, I can read you this quote. It's kind of a crazy. In the age of dog whistles, this one's a good one. Where he says, one of the names is June Havoc. We found out from the motion picture almanac that her real name is June Hovick. Another name was Danny Kaye, and we found out his real name was David Daniel Kaminsky. Another one is Andy Cantor, whose real name is Edward Itzkowitz. There's one who calls himself Edward Robinson. His name is Emmanuel Goldenberg. They are attacking the committee for doing its duty to protect this country and to save the American people from the horrible fate that the communists have meted out to the unfortunate Christian people of Europe. So this is on the floor of Congress. This is what he's saying. And if that's not a like dog whistle to say, hey, look, guys, they're Jews and they're Jewish communists and they're trying to take over the world, I don't know what is. And so there was this real sense within the organized Jewish community of fear of really responding because they didn't want to get labeled as communists too. And so I think this is a complicated time to be Jewish in America because there's this sense of how do we balance a response to this, and at the same time, how do we support those who are being maligned? So I think those are the big Jewish pieces that I've pointed to.
Was the Communist Party or were more socialist groups in the United States, were they disproportionately Jewish?
There were a number of Jews who were involved in these groups. There were a number of other people too. Hoover in particular felt that there was a push to get Jews and blacks and people from minorities involved as a way of promoting racial war and ethnic war. One of the clips, we have a number of clips that we show of movies that respond. One that I excerpted is a movie called I Was a Communist for the FBI. And one of the things that they show is a group of, you know, the communists are organizing a rally for a labor strike. And they bring in these people from New York and the kind of big agent who's super blonde and super kind of like suave looking is like, look, and he shows them how to wrap a newspaper around a pipe so they can just be innocent bystanders going to work in the morning with their newspaper, but they're really going to bludgeon people with pipes wrapped in the newspaper. The newspaper that they're showing is the Jewish Forward, which is in Yiddish at this time. And a lady says, but that's a Jewish newspaper. And the response is, you don't understand how we work here. But like the sense was that they were actually actively trying to promote anti-Semitism and these sorts of things, that this was a calling card of the Communist Party, that they're trying to appeal to these underserved populations.
There are a lot of modern day kind of ties to this era. And when you were talking about, you know, the recruitment of minorities and Jews into communism, specifically when we're thinking about the USSR, in some ways we're dealing with this once again with the Russian troll farms that are trying to digitally enlist people kind of on both sides of the aisles to fight. I don't know if we'd deem it a race war, but certainly trying to raise tensions in America based on these ideological lines. As you were putting together this exhibit, were you thinking about that? Were you thinking about the kind of modern day?
I've been working on this exhibit since the summer of 2015. So it's been a really interesting evolution to see how those kinds of contemporary issues have shifted. When I started, I was like, well, this will be a really interesting way of exploring Islamophobia, you know, looking at the impact, the lasting impact of the Patriot Act and those sorts of things. And while I still think there are conversations to be had about Islamophobia in this country and the way, you know, that we're not having, because there are all of these, you know, the Russian troll farms I haven't even really gotten into, but I mean, who would have expected the NFL would be an actual corollary to the Hollywood blacklist? That, you know, people who take political stances in their place of work are then punished and potentially kicked out of their workplace? Like, I would never have anticipated that as a connection when I started this. And I think that it's one of these things that, for me, exploring this history gives us a way of kind of constructing a discussion, an argument, a thought about what's going on in a current way. One of the big issues that I see that comes out of this is the inability to speak across a divide. And both sides really do feel like they are performing a patriotic duty. And so how do we, and how, what do we take from this to get to a place where we can speak across that divide? Because clearly that is an enormous issue plaguing us today, one that the Russian troll farms are certainly exploiting.
One of the things we haven't really touched on, but seems a very important part of this conversation, political beliefs in this country aren't illegal. You
Correct.
Should be able to have whatever kind of association you want to with any political party.
You know, yeah. Yes, and I think that's one of the things. At the initial hearings, the studio execs, before they cave at the Waldorf conference and end up saying, we're not going to hire any of these people, they keep pushing back against the House on American Activities Committee to say, well, but how would we not hire someone because a political belief is, it's totally legal. You can have difference of opinion. And so they keep pushing HUAC to make some sort of law. HUAC never makes any laws. You know, that this is not what they do. They just keep investigating and investigating and investigating without anything coming back on a legislative side. So it's this interesting moment that, you know, being able to be a member of the Communist Party, voting and however you vote, that's always been a secret ballot. And then being able to speak, those are all protected freedoms in the United States. And yet this is a moment in which people are willing to say, well, those protected categories of rights are less important than our national security. And you find that in times when people feel stressed from a outside source, in this case, it's global international communism, you know, but previously it had been during World War I, you know, the threat of anarchy and all of this globalist type stuff. You have, you know, laws passed in the 1700s. It's the Alien and Sedition Act. That there's always this sense of, I'm willing to forfeit my rights because I'm scared about my physical body. And so I think that this is an amazing test case of that.
And we're still dealing with a lot of the results of that from the blacklist, but also for us, post 9/11. Mm-hmm. The Patriot Act, the mass surveillance of Americans.
And we're willing. You know, nobody is out there really protesting the fact that this happens. You know, you're willing to take your shoes off at the airport because you're like, well, this is keeping me safe. I mean, that's a pretty minute example, but it's still, like, you know, something we do probably every time we travel. I think that there, you know, that there are other kind of lasting legacies. I mean, the people who emerge from this period, this is Richard Nixon's first committee appointment in the House of Representatives. And actually, he makes his political name on HUAC with the Alger Hiss case. And that's how he elevates his career from there. This is Ronald Reagan's first time appearing before the halls of Congress. And as the Red Scare kind of deepens, this really becomes his big political start, you know, as well. And so there's a lot of things that become these kind of holdovers in American history that happen for the next 30, 50 that I think we're still living a little bit in the shadow of.
Ellie Gettinger is the education director at Jewish Museum Milwaukee. Their exhibit is called Blacklist, the Hollywood Red Scare, and is open now through February 10th at the museum. Gettinger spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. The exhibit is also the subject of a feature in the November issue of Milwaukee Magazine. You'll find a link at WUWM.com.